For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable. That's right. For the record, you ain't trying to grow, then it's done for you. That's right. For the record, lab on me going all the way. All the way. For the record, ain't trying to link, no time to waste. Stop calling. For the record, 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 for the record. For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable.
Here we are, season 4, dedicated to amazing women with great stories and inspiring stories of redemption. Wilma Robb was episode 1 and 2. Episode 3, we have another amazing story from a wonderful woman by the name of Nicole Schiller. Nicole has spent years restructuring her life, once addicted to ice. An amazing mother who has come forward many, many years to be an inspiration to many today. Nicole, welcome to The Clink.
Thanks, Brent. Thanks for having me here.
An absolute honor. As you know, season 4, we've dedicated it to amazing stories of redemption, and you have one of those. Mm. Nicole, take us back to your earlier years and where it all began.
So where it all began, I think it began as a curious teenager and, you know, in a country town, as we do, we grow up, we're into our early teenage years. But going back even more from there, you know, I had a good childhood. I grew up on a farm. I was close to the beach. I had loving parents, you know, I had a great childhood. There was nothing in there that took me to a place of real darkness. I experienced, at about the age of 5, I was experienced a cousin of mine that used to take me on his motorbike, and he used to make me do things to him sexually, and it wasn't until I actually realized what I was doing, because I could see for the last time, I could see what I was doing, and he was an older cousin of mine, that I immediately sort of shut shop with speaking up or speaking out about something, because I was actually terrified of him being so embarrassed because he was caught out. And I reckon he would have been about 16. Yeah, I was about 5 or 6. And I also was terrified of what my father would do. You know, I knew he would fucking absolutely tear shreds off him. So there was this element of, what do I do? What do I say? And he definitely smoothed it over before we got back. And he, you know, knowing it was definitely the last time I was ever going to go on a motorbike ride with him. And yeah, you know, as it happens, you can't tell anyone about this. Don't you fucking say anything. And I never did.
That's quite terrible when you're trusting somebody in the family, especially, you know, at that age. The last thing on your mind would be that you're going for a ride and you're going to be abused.
Totally. And the sickening thing was I then realized, fuck, I've been on so many of these motorbike rides with him, and I've had to do this stuff without me being able to see what I'm doing, and just trusting that I didn't even know. I was just doing what I was told. But I think, yeah, once I kind of, I then was aware of what I was doing, and it scared the shit out of me. And I then just felt so sick, and just this sickness of, I've done this so many times and I had no idea.
How was he, Nicole, when, you know, you sort of obviously put your foot down at some stage and, you know, things changed? Was he sort of at that stage, you know, worried that you were going to speak out and, you know, that he would end up in trouble?
I don't know, to be honest. I don't know. Possibly. I just didn't go near him. I just fucking hated him. And he must have been worried that I would say something to my father, you know, knowing if his father or my father found out, and obviously they were brothers, you know, what would go down. But he was a snake, you know?
Did he have much to do in your life as you got older, or was it only just in that period of time when you were so young?
Oh, no, we used to see them. We used to see them quite a bit, and at family barbecues and things like that. And I guess at that age, like if he was 16, you know, he probably was moving off into, you know, 17, 18, and then into the army eventually. But yeah, we used to see them.
I suppose, you know, like, and I speak openly, I guess, children at that age, you know, six and sevens, and, you know, it's all a part of that unknown, and I guess, you know, I guess, well, what was it called? Doctors and nurses, I suppose, or, you know, back when you're kids, you know, you're showering and bathing together, it was nothing out of the ordinary, you know what I mean? Whether it was girls and boys and boys and girls. But at 16 years of age, you're very conscious of what you're doing.
100%. So, so conscious. And, you know, yeah, so conscious of what you're doing. He knew exactly what he was doing with a child and, you know, and then even as an adult, paid no, like there was no remorse. There was no anything about it.
Did you ever have words with him when you got older?
Yeah. As I got older, I didn't actually speak about it until I was, I don't know, in my 20s or late 20s or something. For reasons, you know, which we'll probably get to later. But yeah, I eventually rang and spoke with him about it. And, and you know, as he does, he just let it roll off his back. He just said, you know, oh, look, I'm so sorry about that. And, you know, yes, I'm sure that's how you feel. And that was that, you know. So
was that do you think, a major start to, you know, many years later in reference to you as a person?
I think what it did for me was, at that young age, I learnt not to speak. I learnt not to speak. If I was put in a situation sexually, if I was in a situation with a man that I knew was not right, I didn't have a voice. I didn't have a voice, you know, like I felt like I couldn't speak up. I couldn't tell anyone. I wouldn't fight my way out of it, you know. I would just allow whatever it was to happen, and then I would leave, you know. And that was that became a pattern.
Was that something that, like through schooling or, you know, teenage years, was that something that was relevant to you growing up?
Not really. When I say not really, it was more probably when I got to about the age of 16, 17. Prior to that, from the age of 12 till 16, I was very much, you know, getting into my curiosity. I had filled my curiosity with weed. I was smoking by the age of 12. You know, I was drinking and smoking by the age of 13. And I was good at it. Like what I thought, oh yeah, I can hold my own. I can do this. This is fine, you know. I had a high tolerance to everything at a really young age. And so I wasn't really in those vulnerable situations with other men at that age. It was more I was with my friends, but I was building this pretty solid foundation of a very healthy addiction from a young age, which I didn't know I was doing at the time.
It's funny, you know, like I remember, you know, being 13, 14, and it was the cool thing to go get a case of throwdowns or a foil.
Totally.
And everyone hide down the bush, you know, sit in a cave or wherever we could hide, and, you know, that and a bottle of passion pop or, you know, goon. And it was, I don't know, like, I mean, you speak of coming from a good, solid foundation. you know, for me, it wasn't a solid foundation at all. It was a sort of misfit out there, and just we're trying to be accepted, I suppose. But yet, do you feel that it was possibly something you were doing to mask any sort of trauma or pain that you may have had or felt not being able to speak about it? But yet,
yeah,
you know, like,
sure,
if you could suppress it within drugs or alcohol, that you're having a good time. Fuck everything else. Nothing else matters. And,
yeah,
you know, I'm hanging with my friends and I'm actually doing pretty cool and everyone thinks I'm pretty cool and I'm punching cones and I'm throwing them back.
And it becomes a comfort zone, you know, of I don't have to use my voice. When I'm in this state, I don't have to use my voice and I'm not expected to, not expected to, but because it became such a, I got very good at wearing a mask from a really young age. And I really believe that's where it started.
Did you find it hard to be sociable? Like males, you know, I mean, at that age, obviously, you know, we all sort of experiment, I guess, boyfriend, girlfriends, you know, liking this guy, that chick. You know, it's pretty natural. Did you sort of find that you were a little bit more, nah, fuck off, mate, I'm not, you know, just hanging, having my cones.
I was just hanging with my mates.
Just doing what you wanted to do because you felt good doing that.
Yeah, like I didn't have any interest in a boyfriend. I don't think I actually even had a boyfriend right through high school, you know. I had my friends. I was friends with guys.
But I was not interested in a relationship, you know.
I was more interested in getting wasted and really fucking blind. And, you know, what I thought was just being a teenager. You know, there was not an ounce of that I need to be in a relationship part of me.
Didn't need anybody else. You're independent.
I didn't. I needed my friend. I needed my girlfriends, you know, my best friend, but I didn't need a guy. I had plenty of crutches on guys, but again, I couldn't express that.
How did you find that though at school? Like, were you, you know, doing okay at school, or did you find that you become a little bit wayward and you were sort of, you know, on the outer, drifting out, rebellious sort of?
Mates,
punch
I couldn't
cones
have given
piss.
A shit about learning and passing, you know. I just wasn't, you know.
Were you athletic at all? Were you, you know, interested in any sort of
sport? Oh, yeah, yeah. I love sports. I was really into my sports. So the things I did well was smoke cones, be friends with people, play sports and drink a lot of alcohol, you know. But that's just what I thought all teenagers were like.
Well, in all honesty, let's be real fucking honest here.
Please.
I think that most of us, you know, and I know I'm only speaking, I guess, our generation, you know, what are you? I'm 45. Where are you?
I'm 42.
All right, okay. So our generation, you know, it pretty well was what you did. I mean, I remember, you know, you sneak off and you go down the pub and you score a stick under the table and, you know, it'd be like a block of hash or something and you're just like, hey, fuck, let's go get stoned. For me, I was the drinker. You know, I couldn't handle my canes. I was that guy that'd have two and pass out and everyone throw things at and chips, and, you know, leaves laying on the ground in the bush and just gone. So I didn't enjoy that part. But you're right. Definitely, I think that, you know, it was something that people just did. It was social, and I don't think it was seen as rebellious or anything bad other than from a parental point of view that, oh, you can't do that. Well, fuck you. Yeah, I will. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
But that didn't really set you up for a good stead down the track, did it?
No. My mum, bless her heart, used to say to us, to myself and my two siblings, you know, if ever you start to really like something, you need to be careful of that. And
do you
that
have an addictive personality? Do you find
Okay. I'm black or white, you know, I'm literally all or nothing.
Yep.
And I've always been like that. I have no stop button and I still have that today, even in recovery, you know. I fucking nearly ate myself to death with Easter eggs. I can't stop. Like, and this is what it just reminds me of my using. Like, it gets to a point where it's painful, and it's such an obsession that it's like, wow, man, my disease of addiction is still so active. Yeah. So
you talk about addiction, and it's something that, you know, took a major part of your life. You were addicted to ice, basically, weren't you?
Yeah. Speed, ice was what brought me apart.
So when we talk about it, for me back in the day, it was gas. It was speed. You know, it was just, you know, pretty well cut with glucose, a couple of lines, or, you know, like it was gluggy. But, you know, years went on and it became this crystal meth, and it's an epidemic. Yeah. And it's, as we know it, one of the highest. I mean, back in the day, it was heroin. You know, to me, I've seen a lot of friends lose their lives and lose their everything to the gear. In your case, it was the uppers, and, you know, you ended up at 19, I believe, with a very, very high addiction. For you, talk the listener through. I don't think people understand how much of a high you get from that first hit, especially with ice.
I would say, for the first hit with ice, to be truly honest with you, by the time I started using ice, nothing was working. So if I can take you back to the early days of when I first started using I clearly remember the first time I ever had speed, and I remember going out, and we had the fucking greatest night of our lives, and it was, you know, I just remember getting to about 6 o'clock the next day, and I was like, what the fuck was that stuff? Like, this is, what was that? Oh my God. And I was in this relationship with a professional footballer that lived in Sydney, and here I was in Kingscliff with a very hurting heart, you know, desperately missing him, and then got introduced to speed, you know, and my heart stopped hurting for one night. And I remember saying to my friends, like, you've got to introduce me to that person. Wherever the fuck we got that from, take me to that person. So I went and I met that person, and I said, I'm going to be coming to you every weekend. Like, you're going to see a lot of me. And he was like, okay, great, you know. And
so you were adamant. That was it. That was your happy high.
That was me. That was me. I was like, right, that's me from here on in. Like, that's great. And it was like, yeah, it was just like this homecoming of, okay, great, this is exactly for me. And I think I probably used for every weekend for 4 weeks. And then within that time, it had straight away gone into a daily use. And so from the age of 19, I used daily all of it, you know, the speed when it became the GAC, you know, and it was poey, you know, all this. Ugh.
What was that? It went from that, and then it had the ox blood.
Yes. All of it. And you know what? And my brain was frying. Yeah, yeah.
Because you'd keep you up all night. You'd be partying, drinking, and then you'd just be cooked.
Cooked, so cooked. And mentally, you know, here's me thinking, I'm having the absolute time of my life here. As you do, and you think everything's functioning around you. And, you know, slowly but surely everything started crumbling, and I was holding on, and I was still holding down a job. But then I needed more, you know, and then there was MDMA, there was the acid, there was all of it. There was all of it going around in excess, and none of it was enough. And so I know by the time I got to using ice, it was never going to be enough. And so the more that I I could consume it and consume it. I could literally consume ice and then go to bed, you know, and then wake up.
Really?
Yep.
Like I know people, for example, as we just said before, that were, you know, heavily addicted to heroin. Mm. Now, growing up, there was a lot I seen in Sydney, you know, you just seen it was just people were on the nod left, right and centre, sitting in gutters, bus stops. It didn't matter, sitting there. You just knew they were stoned.
Yeah.
But they couldn't function without it. Then I would see people that I knew that had high tolerances and you know, had been using for some time. They could do anything. You wouldn't ever know. If you knew that their eyes were pinned, that'd be about the only giveaway and a slight tint, the roughness in their voice. But outside of that, they could go to bed, eat, do that everything. They could, like, people, it just blew me away. And you're obviously...
I was highly functioning, yeah. I was, you know, I literally would hold down jobs in real estate agents. I worked in the last in place I worked
the last
at,
place
you know,
I
with
worked
executives,
at,
you know, with executives of these big corporation, places,
you know, with this raging ice addiction.
In big round table meetings, you know, just, yeah.
Did it give you confidence, Nicole? Like, did it actually make you feel that you're unstoppable, especially being in those sort of positions?
Early days it did. Definitely by the time I got to those positions and how progressive my addiction was, I was fucking chasing my tail the whole time because I couldn't remember anything. I was in a position where I was an executive PA and someone would tell me something. I couldn't fucking remember what they said. They'd tell me and it'd be gone, you know, I didn't feel powerful. I felt so fucking powerless because I couldn't stop using.
Were you scared of how you would be if you didn't have it?
I guess I probably didn't even consider that. I think the longest I could go was 2 days without using. And in that point, when I would get to the 2 days, you know, I was in complete withdrawal and exhaustion and I couldn't function.
When you talk about withdrawal, can you just explain to the listener what it's like to have an addiction with methamphetamine or ice and what someone goes through? I mean, we always talk, I guess, publicly, oh, yes, they're going through withdrawals or, you know, whatever drug it may be. But I don't think to the person that truly has never understood what the addiction's about, they wouldn't know how bad the withdrawals are and the cravings.
Mm.
Talk us through that.
So the withdrawals for me were extreme exhaustion. You know, I couldn't, I would obviously be incredibly shaky. Like everything was just like this. My body would be, my hands would be like this. And I wouldn't be able to finish sentences. I would start a sentence and I would literally say 3 words and then I couldn't remember what I was saying. So I couldn't even have a hold a conversation. So I'd be like this, trying to speak to you, and I'd go to say, and then I'd look at you and go, what was I just saying? And they're like, I don't fucking know. No, I couldn't function at all. And I physically couldn't stay awake. I physically would be, you know, like on the nod, you're on the nod, you just, everything would shut down. And then I would get to the 2 days.
What was the longest, Nicole, that you were awake for? Do you remember?
To be honest, I reckon I was probably in my early days. I reckon I probably went the longest I went was about 4 days awake.
Wow.
And
would you take like sleepers to try and bring you down, or would it just get to the point where you just switch off and say, no, I've had enough, that's it?
Oh, no, I'd smoke. I'd smoke, but I wouldn't, you know. Never. I've never dabbled in any prescription pills or downers. It was just always skyrocket.
You see a lot of people these days, you know, they've got to have their still knocks. They have their medicine, as they call it, or their drug of choice, and, you know, they've got to have that downer. You know, generally it's that still knocks tablet or, you know, to bring them back. And you didn't need to.
I was just on full tilt the whole time until I fell, you know, until I crashed. And the crash would be fucking horrendous. You know, the paranoia would kick in. I was severely paranoid for years. You know, I would have moments. I would go into a psychosis. I never actually went into hospital because I would stay within my home, and I would go through all this bullshit mentally. You know, for so many years, you know, I would hide behind the fence listening to the next door neighbors talking, thinking they were talking about me. I would go to the other side of the fence on the other side of the house, and I would be listening to their, trying to pick up what they were saying. And then the kids would walk out and be like, "Hey, Mum, what are you doing?" I'm like, "Oh, nothing, nothing. It's all good," you know, and I'd pretend I...
You had had your children by this stage.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're a mum as well.
I was a mum as well.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, my mask wearing was really strong. It was really strong. You know, I didn't use... Once I knew I was pregnant, I used heavily while both of the children were in me before I knew I was pregnant. And then once I knew, I stopped. But I craved it every time, you know. I craved it.
Was your group of friends, like, you know, were they also in the same sort of way of life? Were they doing the same things? Or was it just sort of at that point you become just you on your own and you had to cut everybody off to...
I mean, my friends stay were away doing from it. But I was using the most, you know. It with the different pregnancies, I was sort of surrounded by different people. I know with my son and around that time and those group of friends, you know, we were all partying, but there was an element of partying, and then there was an element of how much shit Nicole had on her, and it was like, fuck, man, this is just a barbecue, you know, you're set up for the next 5 days. It's like, yeah, cool. So in a sense, my friends knew. I don't think they knew to the depth of how much I craved using and just wanting the drugs even while I was pregnant. And, you know, and everyone would sit around talking all this mum stuff, and I just didn't give a fuck. Like, I just wanted to use.
Did that have any effect during the pregnancy or after your children had been born?
Thankfully it didn't, no. I was petrified.
Yeah.
Because the sad thing was I was petrified that for both of them, you know, that I had done something. And I remember one beautiful midwife saying to me, and I was really honest with them. I was like, look, I've done this and this and used this and this and this amounts. And
I think that's important though. If you're, you know, if you're bringing a child into the world, and you're not sort of saying, look, there's every chance this could possibly be in their system, or,
yeah,
you know, like I'm, you know, when I was younger, there was a lot of, as I known, dome babies, you know, born with addiction, which would then, you know, have to go through methadone program basically as a baby.
As a baby, yeah.
You know, and...
So the ice addiction was after the kids were born. The ice addiction... Yeah, it was when the kids were younger, but it was definitely more the alcohol and the amphetamines, not so much like the crystal, but copious amounts of it, you know.
Did you find that it was almost like a godsend finding ice, as opposed to, you know, like, I mean, look, let's be honest again. I mean, I remember I used to sniff speed. That was my drug of choice when I was younger, 15, 16. I was on the gas, just loved that, and pills. I was the upper. And you know, it went pretty shit pretty quick.
Yeah.
You know, when someone's giving you pretty well glucose and you're like, fucking what? You know, then for me, I never went down the trial or taking or touching. I mean, I had enough of it around me, enough people going through it for me to just go, no, fuck that. So the ice didn't interest me. Mm. But what I seen in the difference of the person from what they were on the gas or, you know, the goey or whatever you want to call it, the speed, was a fucking massive jump.
Massive jump. Massive jump. And I noticed that myself, you know, but yeah, I fucking, you know, I have friends. I've lost many friends.
I mean, people wouldn't understand you outside of your sort of group of people that knew you or what you were doing. I mean, the average person.
You get quite isolated though. Like you're using circles. But certainly, you know, what I noticed with some of my really beautiful longtime friends and we would all use, you know, but we separated.
So day becomes night, night becomes day, and it's all irrelevant what's going on outside those four walls.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. 100%. Yeah.
Where did it really, I guess, smack you in the head, so to speak, and you go, fuck, I'm not enjoying this anymore. Something has to change. Was it one time or was it a couple of times?
It was many times. I was the kid's father and I, who are really beautiful friends now, lived in a really codependent, long 15-year relationship. And there was many really beautiful times, but there was a lot of heaviness and addiction and a lot of times in that 15 years that I wanted to die. I just believed that I would die early because my heart would either stop or I would end up killing myself.
Was that something that you were just, okay, that's just how it is and that's my that's my journey, that's my destiny.
Yeah.
Sooner or later, it's just going to be all over and, you know, I'm going to be dead and I'm whatever. The addiction's over and life goes on.
Yeah. Yes. And yeah, that's exactly right. I couldn't, there was no, I didn't even consider myself a drug addict.
They tend to, well, I shouldn't say they, people with addictions, especially those that don't want to move forward from it, tend to live in denial.
Oh, oof.
You know, it's everybody else's problem. I don't have a problem. You know, I'm not an addict. But yet, you know, you'll go and rob someone for this, be dishonest with that, sell yourself, do whatever you've got to do just to have that hit.
Yes. Do
you
whatever.
You know, but at the end of the day, you are okay.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And my denial was so strong, you know, to have such a heavy addiction for so many years and not even consider, you know, I know the kid's dad used to say to me that I had a drinking problem or, you know, you've had so much more or all the things. And I would just go, and you're a fuckwit, you know, like it's not me, it's you, or it's not me, it's them. And
like, who are you to tell me sort of thing?
Oh, who are you to tell me that I've got a fucking drug problem, you know?
Yeah.
I moved out. I sort of thought for the last time I knew I needed to get out of where I was. And, because I could feel my death coming. I knew I was going to die. And I thought if I try this, if I move, I might have a chance. And so I did. And then I just got deeper and deeper into my addiction, even deeper.
Were the children with you at that stage?
Yeah. And I was still working. You know, but this was near the end, and and it was only then, and I think I remember before I moved, it was before my 36th birthday, and I would pray to God, I would cry myself to sleep every night, please keep me alive, please let me live. And but I did not want to live. But I prayed. I would just sob myself to sleep because I knew that I was going to die really soon. I felt like I was going to die really soon. My body was so fucked. My brain was not functioning.
It just goes to show the power of the drug. You got two beautiful children there that you would do anything for. But behind the closed doors and take the mask off, there's nothing left within you.
Nothing. Nothing left within me. My soul was dead. Was absolutely dead. And I know my mum said that to me one time. It was when I got clean and she's like, oh, you know, you use the kids as motivation to stay clean. And I was like, you know what? I planned to shoot myself, in the head because I could not live in the paranoia and I could not live with my head any longer. And I knew where I was going to do it so that the kids weren't going to be able to find, but be the first people to find me. You know, I would stare at trees. I would look at guardrails while the kids were in the car with me. I was so fucking suicidal. And I said to Mum, nut.
Isn't suicidality such a scary thing? I can relate that so much. You know, I went through a really dark time there when I was driving trucks around Australia at one stage. And you say trees. I don't know how many trees I'd looked at thinking how I could put the trailer up close enough to it to throw a rope over it.
Yeah.
It's a scary, scary thought.
It's so fucking real. And I really get it when I hear, you know, when I get news that a friend of mine passed just recently, and I fucking get it.
You do, don't you? You really do. I've spent years myself helping people, as you would know, with mental health and suicide prevention and things like that. And it's just, you do get it. Once you're a survivor, I mean, the suicidality is always there. It never sort of leaves your mindset, no matter how strong you become. You know, it's there. But you always want to try and help others through it. From that lived experience, I find anyway. And I think that, if anything, it's a bit of a blessing. You know, your brother was a massive part, wasn't he, of the change?
Massive part.
Why was that, Nicole? What was so influential of your brother that nobody else could get, you know, into your mindset or, you know, help you, I suppose? How did that come about?
It came about because is 3 years ahead of me in recovery.
So he also too used
his name, but yeah, he's predominantly alcohol, a huge coke addiction, and we're addicts. We were born addicts. You know, our pop was an alcoholic and a huge prescription pill addict, and so that's what Mum said. That's what Mum meant. All those years back when we were younger, if ever there's something that you really like, you must be careful. That was my mum's way of saying, guys.
It's hereditary, this addictive personality.
It's hereditary, like you've got it in your genes.
Got you.
But back to Ben, yeah. He got clean in London. His world fell apart hugely. And he checked himself into rehab in London and I remember seeing him. He was back in Australia before he got clean, and he was fucking messy. And it was a shock. It was like, yeah, wow. But I think the difference, I spoke about it, and he was like, Nick, you're no different to me. And he said, the only difference is, he said, you use like I drink, and you always have. And the only difference with it was that the alcohol would make him so drunk and dysfunctional that, you know, he couldn't even walk, whereas mine was amphetamines and meth. So even if my body couldn't walk, body was fucking walking, you know?
Yeah. Well, the thing was, too, you could be as drunk as, and you're not drunk.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That was like me. You know, I could sit at the clubhouse for days on the coke and drink bottle after bottle, and everybody's like, fucking what? And
just normal.
Just normal, yeah. Well, everyone else is getting messy.
Yeah, totally. And so Ben could see, he had come back, he'd been in rehab, and he'd come back to Australia to begin his recovery journey. And, you know, he could see where I was at. And he would just drop little nuggets. He took me to a meeting, my first NA meeting. He rang me and he's like, oh, I've got to go to a meeting. And they've told me I have to take a support person. Will you come with me? And I was like, yeah, for sure. You know, I fucking got out of the pipe.
Even in that mindset and your addiction, you were happy still to support your brother.
Oh, yeah. That much denial. I didn't even consider.
Didn't have a problem.
I don't have a problem. Yeah, no worries. I'm going to rack up four lines and then I'm going to jump on the ice pipe and I'm going to get really, really wise.
Sit in an NA meeting going, wow.
And then I'll go to an NA meeting and support my brother. You know, like, no idea. I had no idea what I was walking into.
Yeah.
But yeah, I remember that so fucking clearly. I remember being in that room and it was filled with people from, you know, the teenager to the businesswoman to the father to the farmer to the businessman to the bikie to the... I was just like, wow.
Doesn't discriminate, does it? Addiction, it's the same as mental health, you know? It doesn't discriminate.
No. You know, and there were people that would stand up that were 30 years clean. Stand up if you're 30 years clean, you know? And they'd stand up and they'd get a clap and... You know, 10 years clean. And I was like, and I was like sitting there a bit cocky going, oh, whatever, you know. But it was the ones that were 2 days clean that fucking rocked me. Like, because I couldn't get 2 days clean.
So that really, you know, just hit you and said, listen, you got to fucking wake up.
Yeah. Oh, well, I think even then that was when I was still really convinced that I was just going to die to my addiction. Because I couldn't get 2 days clean. I didn't even want to. But I wanted to not be paranoid and in the psychosis. But I was prepared to blow my head off.
Do you find today, and we'll get into this a little more shortly, because you've become such an inspirational and powerful person within yourself that helps many, many, many women. Do you find that you've conversed that addictive strength now into a leadership strength, something that, you know, you can inspire others with? Because obviously you've got that trait. You've got that trait within you. Yeah, okay, you've got that addictive sense, but you've also too got that strength because, you know, to do what you did, live the way you lived, and constantly be in denial, I get the addiction, but it's got to have a bit of character as well, you know, and like you say, sitting in an NA meeting. Not my problem. You know what I mean? Like, high as a kite.
I'm fine.
I'm cool. I'm sweet. Like, how, you know what I mean? How was it for you to be able to just go, fuck, I do have a problem. I need to change. Like,
so what it was the, by the time I'd moved out from the kids' dad, I'd left the family home and the kids and I were living somewhere else and, you know, and I think it was only then that I realised how hungry my addiction was, even more. And, you know, I couldn't hold down my job. I was missing days all the time. I was not turning up. I was turning up to parent-teacher interviews like this, you know, like in an outfit to go to an executive meeting, but just fucked. And, you know, dropping the kids off to school just as they get out of the car, grabbing my cigarette, lighting up my cigarette before I haven't even driven off from the pickup zone, you know. Shit like that, where it's like it might not be massive to some people, but for a mother that's really unraveling, that's been highly functioning, you know, to smoking crack down in her car in her lunch break, or I'll just go and move my car and I'm on the pipe, you know, like it was just
finding any excuse to just get
any
that.
Excuse. Yeah. But yeah, but it was clear, it was really clear, and I distinctly remember the night that I knew, okay, I'm going to make the phone calls and I'm going to put this into action of my suicide. And fortunately, with the grace of God, my brother rang me that morning and he asked me, you know, how are you actually traveling, Nick? And it's so weird because I...
Did he know how deep into your addiction you were?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But he didn't want to push too hard because he knew I would... Because with an addict, as you know, like, you fucking push us and we're going to go, fuck you, I don't want to see you. So he was very mindful of how and which way to drop the message to me. But yeah, it was a matter of, he literally just called at the right time and asked me how I was actually really going and how my using was going. And I just remember, or how my head was. And I remember thinking it at the time. I remember thinking, do I tell him I've now got the gun? I'm now ready to go. I'm ready to do it all. And as I was thinking it, I've obviously said it. I must have said it because I don't remember actually saying it, but I remember thinking it. Do I say this to him or do I shut my mouth so I can keep using?
So your consciousness just took over and out it came. Blech.
Whatever I said.
Yeah.
But I don't even know. But I do remember saying, I've been waiting for us to have this conversation. You please just try my way first.
Do you think these years later that, and I maybe you've had the conversation, that he ever felt that he was going to lose his sister in his heart?
Fuck yeah.
That he was scared that no longer would his sister be there, and you know, him reaching out was his way of trying to prevent that, obviously, from occurring.
Yeah. He had told me a couple of times he'd had dreams of me, of him standing over my coffin, and with the kids, and with their dad, and the family, and he would tell me, and I was like, oh yeah. You know, he was really aware that I was very close to my own death as well. Yeah, he knew he was losing his sister.
What made you hang in there? What was the change?
The only thing that I hung on to was he saying, please just try my way first. And if my way doesn't work, then go for your life. Please just try it. Try my way first. And if it doesn't work, then you can go for your life.
Well, obviously you tried his way.
All right. I'll try it. Whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I did. I nearly died in between that and getting into it. But that's what he just said to me, you know, like.
When you say you tried his way, what was his way? What was different about?
Go to rehab.
Okay. So it was pretty black and white, like everybody else with addiction.
Yeah.
Now, I want to ask you something, because I've had, you know, friends in the past who have tried to help with addiction. Mm. And the biggest hurdle that we've found is you can't just put your hand up and get straight into a rehab. Mm. They want you to be clean for a period of time before you even come in. You've got to do urines. You've got to do tests. Yeah. Did you go through that as well? And how did you get through that short period, which would have felt like forever,
it was,
to then get into the front door of the rehab?
Yeah. I think that was probably the longest time of my life, to be honest. Like, every 24 hours felt like fucking...
What was it, 7 days or 10 days you got to do, was it?
No, I had to wait 3 months before I could get in.
Holy shit, 3 months you had to be clean.
Oh, no. 3 months before I could actually get in. I couldn't. Oh, fuck no. I couldn't. I was not clean. I had to detox in I ended up going to Thailand.
Did you go over and do that one in oh, where is it? The one with the monks at the temple.
No, that is, I can't remember what that one was called, but no, I did another one.
I watched
one.
The documentary on that, Nicole, and it was, wow, that's all I've got to say. And for anybody out there whom, oh, for God's sake, I'd love to be able to remember the name of it. Look, I'm sure you can find it on YouTube if you Google it. It's a Thai temple for addiction.
Yeah.
And it is a very, very powerful short documentary that will give you a good insight. And if anybody out there is struggling at the moment, I know that we can't sort of fly out of the country and what have you, but it may give you a little bit of hope, and it might actually, you know, want you, it may put you stepping forward to recovery, to watch this and reach out in Australia. So,
yeah.
Thailand, wow.
Yeah.
How the fuck did you fly over there? Were you stoned? Or were you high, sorry?
I was as high as a fucking kite. I was relieved, but I was...
Were you excited about going over there? Were you actually thinking about getting the meth over there? Because, you know, they've got the Yabar, which is, you know, 4 million.
I was so desperate. Like, I just didn't even... I was relieved to get on the plane to go, thank fuck, I have now been taken out of the country where I know I can use anywhere and everywhere. I wasn't as ballsy to go to Thailand and then try and fucking score ICE as soon as I got off the plane.
Well, there's massive repercussions, isn't there, which we all know. So,
yeah.
You know, I guess that's a good way of putting yourself in a position.
Yeah. But yeah, it was 3 months before I could get in. I tried around everywhere here. The reason I went over there was, I couldn't stay clean, you know, and I fucking take my hat off to every person that does it here.
It's powerful, isn't it? Like a lot of people, and I've seen it, you probably know it, and, you know, people go to rehab next minute, they're getting drops and, you know, they've got their buddies coming in and, you know, like, I think today's a little bit harder to get away with it. But then again, at the end of the day, if they want it bad enough, they're going to get it.
Yeah, for sure. I would have just fucked off. I would have just gone. So, yeah, I needed to be somewhere where I could not escape. And, that waiting time was sheer living hell, absolute sheer living hell. Every 24 hours, I wondered if I was going to wake up. And I had to, and I woke up to children, and I was like, okay, I'm still alive, you know. It was sheer living hell.
Thailand, what was Thailand like to be away from anybody and everybody you knew, like you said, throwing yourself out there to be helped?
Look, to be really honest with you, it was, it saved my life. I knew I was not there for a holiday. I was there to either stop myself from killing myself or, you know, I knew I had to do the work when I got there. So, for me, Thailand was an incredibly safe place for me to be, because where I couldn't run, I had to be, I was in a compound where we, you know, we couldn't fucking get out.
So it wasn't a hospital, it was an actual, like, facility, proper.
It was a facility, yeah.
Was it a locked-in sort of thing? Once you sign yourself over, that's it, you're there? There's no coming out until you successfully get through the program?
Yeah, yeah. And look, and there was a lot of shit that went down, you know. There were people that would come in and leave and... there was no using in there, thank fuck.
A lot of Phalang, a lot of white people, or a more more Thai, or what was it sort of?
The ground staff were Thai. The psychology staff were, there was one from Philippines, New Zealand, India, the UK. There was quite a few Aussies, surprise, surprise.
But quite multicultural.
Yeah.
And did you find that there were people from all over the world there as well? All there for the same reason, yeah. Trying to get well?
Some not as hungry as others. Some just there because they're trying to save their marriage or, you know, some because mum and dad have sent them there. But there are a few that were in desperate help, in desperate need of something other than themselves.
How long was that for?
I stayed for 7 weeks.
Yeah. Yep.
And I couldn't stay any longer because of the kids. The kids were at home with my parents. Yeah. And
so mum and dad were supportive. They, in the end, yeah. I guess, knew what was going on.
Yeah. Yeah. They had no idea to the depth of my addiction and my and ice. They had no idea. They always knew that I was that I'd had a long-standing addiction, but I don't think they realised to the extent of what it was. Mm.
That's amazing. But yet they'll beside you through your toughest times.
Yeah, bless their hearts. Yeah.
Hey?
Yeah, they really were. Well, they got to walk through it with my brother, which was handy. Well, so he kind of paved the way.
Speak. And has he been? I don't want to get into, you know, the private side of your family, but has he been successful since then? He's
still in recovery.
Recovery. Yeah, great. Good on him.
Yeah. It's beautiful. Like I remember ringing him from rehab and saying, "Fuck, man! Like we get to do this shit together." Like, what a gift. What a gift. Ooh. That we actually, yeah.
But in saying that too, will we talk about having the right support networks around us to overcome addiction, you know? And it is extremely powerful to have a positive support team, you know? Mm. What better than somebody whom one loves you unconditionally, your brother?
Yeah.
Two, that understands addiction. The three is also in recovery.
Yeah.
You know, to be able to lift each other in your toughest times and hold each other up when you're struggling, that's extremely powerful. And I think that's a really unique and beautiful thing that you guys do have. As terrible as it must have been for mum and dad and the kids, but, you know, to look at the upside of it, which we have to. This is something that has been a massive turning point, and it is a big positive in yours, your children's, your parents, or your friends and what have you. I mean, how's the relationship today? It's stronger than ever?
They're all stronger because I'm not full of shit anymore. They knew the truth. They knew the truth when I went to Thailand. They knew the truth. I was open with them. I mean, my daughter was younger, so she doesn't really remember a lot. She remembers me going away, but my son remembers everything.
I think it's important, you know, like we talk about certain things in our lives. I mean, my children, obviously, you know, one of my sons was born whilst I was in custody, and my daughter was very dependent, and yet I left for many, many years to go to jail for drug importation. So, you know, coming home, it's a different world, and they only got to Google. And, you know, to me, I think honesty is the key to their better future. I've always said it and always will. My wrongs are their rights. And I think, you know, they can come to me and ask me. You know, there's no need for hiding. There's no need for curiosity. I mean, my oldest son's 22 and so proud of him. And, you know, it's just he's everything that I wasn't. In reference to, you know, my ways of living. You know, he's a sound engineer and at uni, and I couldn't be prouder. But I think a lot of that came from the realism of my life, not hiding it, not involving them as in bringing the children into your bad times as such, but they live it as well. You know, there's traumas there that they've got to deal with now as they get older. But I feel that if you can be honest with them, it's definitely got to be healing for them.
100%. I remember the day that I told my son that I needed to go to rehab, that I I had I can't remember if I said to him I had a really powerful drug addiction and I needed to go to rehab and to get better and or to help me get better. And you know, the relief on his face at the age of, he could have been 10 then, 11, the relief on that child's face was like he just dropped into this, oh, okay, I understand. Like, even if he didn't understand, but I think he saw so much, he was around so much, he wanted his mum to be well, he didn't know how to help or he didn't know what to do and he didn't understand until he heard those words. And then it was like, I just remember this shift in him because I was really frightened to tell him, to go, fuck, do I do this to the kids at this age? Do I say this stuff? And I thought, and I had a lot of people say to me, you can't tell them, you can't do this. I'm like, I need to, you know?
I think it's also to ownership. You know, as a parent, I mean, you know, my middle fella, whom, you know, my partner fell pregnant when I was arrested. She was 4 months pregnant, 4.5 months pregnant. So, you know, 4 years of his life, I wasn't there and I didn't see him born out of my four children. And there's no bad time for him to ask a question. There's nothing that he can't ask. There's nothing that I won't be honest with him about. You know, there's obviously certain things that I will sort of put a little bit of a blanket over till he's a bit older. But in hindsight and the reality of, you know, understanding who you are as mum or who you are as dad and them understanding who they are as your child, I think it's important that, you know, we don't hide, we don't pretend. And, you know, I think in later years it just comes back to bite you in the ass.
Oh my God, yes. Yeah. You know, and I say this to my kids, the most loving thing you can do is tell someone the truth. And with my recovery, I don't have to, but I choose to be rigorously honest with myself and others every day, you know. If I get to a point where I start not being honest with myself or others, I feel like I'm putting that mask back on.
You talk about your honesty with others, and I this is, you know, something that I'm really excited to talk about, because in each of our stories of redemption, all our amazing guests, they all start with a shocking, you know, start. I mean, that's where you get your story of redemption. And Nicole, you give a lot back to others. You help so many people in what you do. You're spiritually, you're passionate, you're connected, you're at peace. What is it that you're doing today? Let's talk about it. Because I think that it's something that, you know, we really need to share.
Yeah, thank you. I do feel all of that today. And, you know, along with my continuing to maintain my recovery in my 12 steps program, but I
do you attend NA with your brother, or just in general?
Well,
sorry.
Yeah, we do. Yeah, yeah. If we're lucky enough to sit in a meeting together,
that was my point. A little bit from that supportive, yeah. Like we were talking about, you know, togetherness of taking. But
totally.
You're strong enough to present on your own, and you're comfortable with that now.
Yeah, yeah. So. NA has become such a core part of my life, and the 12 steps program is, you know, it's my maintenance.
And it's Narcotics Anonymous, isn't it? For those
Narcotics
that aren't
Anonymous.
Familiar with what we're talking about.
Yeah. So Narcotics Anonymous, I will do Alcoholics Anonymous when I can, because alcohol's a drug as well. It, for me, it's, if I was to allow myself to have a drink, you know, my little wall goes, oh yeah, everything's okay, and then I go back to the same thing. So that's what the 12 steps do. I'm a part of Narcotics Anonymous, and you know, I do service in the community. I'm also,
you're a successful businesswoman.
I'm also a successful businesswoman, for God's sakes.
And you help people. This is the beautiful thing, and you know, Wilma Robb, who we just had on, you know, I look forward to everybody's, you know, comments, because what a powerful story. But, you know, she spent the last 30 odd years just giving back and helping people. Mm. And, you know, I think that people who have lived experience have so much value in this world. And I've said this forever and a day, especially working in the mental health space and stuff like that. No longer is it about a textbook, you know, no longer is it just about a degree or, you know, listening to a doctor. The person like yourself that had the addiction, that's in recovery, person like myself that's lived, you know, the life that I've lived, we have value finally. You know, we have a life that can be shared to help others.
Yeah, there's something to be said about someone with the lived experience versus someone that studied it at uni, you know. Why? Because we understand the behaviour, we understand the thought pattern, we understand the isolation, you know, we can pick the certain behaviours.
The body language and the telltale signs. I've said that for years, you know, that was one of my gifts growing up on the streets. I basically studied body language.
I'm
very comfortable walking into anywhere, any place with any amount of people and reading the play.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a bit of a gift. Had I not lived and the
it's
way that
huge
I lived,
gift.
I wouldn't have that.
The people that have gotten me clean are all ex-addicts, you know.
There you go.
That's how it works. And so, yeah, that is my, you know, my mission is to, which I am doing now through breathwork and embodiment.
What is your business called? And just
so my business
for the viewers,
is called
like
Soul Reset.
And it's on Instagram and Facebook and all those websites and stuff.
Yeah. So it's purely through Instagram and Facebook at the moment. And what I do, I'm a breathwork facilitator, and breathwork is an ancient healing modality that heals and assists people with PTSD, schizophrenia, severe anxiety, mild anxiety, you know, anyone that is constantly in that fight or flight mode. You know, we live in a world of busyness, and all of us do, you know, especially coming from a background of amphetamines. My go-to was constant. Yeah,
go,
it was
go,
constant.
Go, go. Everything's in
say
fast
no to nothing
times
and never
10.
Fucking slow down, nah. You know.
You wow. Did you so, even breathe?
No. So when I was introduced to breathwork, when someone actually facilitated me in breathwork one time, and I just was like, what the fuck? It was actually the same effect as what the first time I used.
Really? Just euphoric? Euphoric, or it's more like a rush, or?
So the brain releases the natural DMT in our brain when we do breathwork. So I actually experienced that, and I was like, what the fuck have we just done? Like, how I feel so different. Like, I felt so activated. And so then that's when I began my journey and my curiosity and my searching and my learning about breathwork. Was because it was the freest I had felt since probably the last time I'd taken something that really opened me up. And that was a lot of years, because the drugs stopped working very early on in the piece. So,
do you find though that, and I know that this might sound a little bit sort of funny, but it hasn't. And I'm not going to say it. Most people say, oh, you know, you swap one for the other, or, you know, you're always chasing that high.
But it started that way.
Okay, so it did. So it started that way, and then you've obviously seen it as a way of life, a beautiful, positive
lifestyle.
Yeah, that allows you to be free of all the negative and to feel strong within yourself and successful within your recovery. Did you sort of meet anyone along the way that you've helped that has a similar story?
Plenty of women.
Wow.
I do have quite a few men that approach me and say, does your stuff work for men too? And
well,
it does.
It?
Yeah.
Is it specifically just for male or female, or is it across the board? I mean, we all breathe.
It's across
the board.
We've
all got fucking brain and chemicals.
Yeah, exactly. We all, it's across the board for everyone. So generally, what I do is through breathwork journeys, we tend to, I facilitate somatic energy release work, which is where we go deeply into our body. We access the trauma, the stored emotion in our body, and we physically release it, which is pretty messy work. Like it's really intense and it's really fucking beautiful.
Does it bring out a lot of emotion in people?
Huge emotion.
Yeah.
Huge emotion. And a lot of people get fearful of feeling their emotions, you know? Hence why we suppress so much.
That's what I was just about to say, but it is something, I mean, like for me, you know, being a sexually abused survivor and physically abused, you know, and then going into club life, as I learned about myself and went deeper into my recovery and my healing, I believed that it was always that little boy, not hiding, but protecting myself in that environment, you know, and being sort of powerful, stronger, aggressive and, you know, dominating because I was just trying to protect that inner boy.
Yeah.
You know, and I feel that not just me, but the people in general all have that within them.
Everyone has that inner child that is yearning something to be heard, to be felt, to be understood. I don't know if there would be many people in this world that doesn't have something within them from a young age that has from that young, that inner child that plays outward into their adult life. And this is part of the work that I do as we journey back into there. And because, you know, when I say trauma doesn't always mean something really huge, a huge event. Yeah. When fear gets trapped in our body, it could be like when we're little and a door slams. Mm. And if you were to
just jump, yeah.
Jump, you actually energetically feel a wave of energy go through your body, and that's
the
fear.
Sound of a voice, someone raising their voice, or
yeah,
like a squeak or something. Oh, you know, that's so true. It doesn't have to be a physical trauma as such, does it?
It doesn't have to be a physical trauma. Physical traumas 100% get stored in there, and they're in there, and there's a lot of stuff that gets stored in there. But it can be as small as a door slamming, you know, and that fear gets stuck in our body. And unless we learn about this work and we get facilitated in this sort of stuff for us to be able to physically release the fear from our body, it stays there, and we stay stuck in these circles of going round and round, and we wonder why we attract the same similar people and scenarios. And, you know, you can talk to, I'm all for all recovery and psychology, but it wasn't until I learned this deep somatic energy release work that's when I went, holy fuck. This is what everyone needs to learn and to experience.
How does it help you? We talked about earlier, you know, with, I guess, paranoia or form of schizophrenia. I may be wrong in saying that. I don't know if you were diagnosed or whether it was just part of. You know, do you find today that your mind is clear and you're able to have freedom without feeling that paranoia? And, you know, because a lot of people come out of addiction, but yet there's long-term issues that they have to then live with because, you know, we damage our brain cells. We really do internally destroy ourselves. It's just a fact.
Mm. Yeah.
Do you feel that you today are good?
Most of the time. I definitely have days.
I love that. That's really honest. And you know, like, that just tells me how honest you are being, because, you know, You said you're in recovery still, so therefore you'll always be in recovery.
Mm.
But now, you know, you're making yourself vulnerable, even though you're expressing the wonderful things that you do do with people and your business and so on, but you still do have these times.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah. Yep. I still have days where I'm so in my head and I get so paranoid and I overthink things, you know, and then that will lead me down the path of going, I don't want to use today, but I'll go to, how can I end this?
I'll eat chocolate.
Oh, I'll eat chocolate. I'll eat myself to death with chocolate. You know, that's a nice, slow, painful death.
isn't that amazing, though? Like, and I guess people need to understand that someone that lives in recovery will always have that temptation in the back of their mind, no matter how good life is, how clean your life is, and all the beautiful things in it. But there's still always that thought that, oh, if I just had one, or just had a little bit now, I'd be sweet, you know, just to have a bit of fun. But the reality of it is there is no fun. It is no little bit. It's a raging fucking habit that becomes an absolute massive addiction and turmoil and just vortex of fucking hell.
Yeah, I couldn't express that better than how you just said it just then.
It really is, and I don't think there's any other way to describe it. You know, you're it's always on that fine line, aren't you? But you're making every possible effort to never go down that road again.
Yeah.
And that to me is a story of redemption. I think, you know, to me, anybody that lives in recovery daily, and there's a lot of people out there who have amazing stories of redemption that have lived some horrific lives and experienced terrible traumas and things, never been addicted to any drugs or anything like that, but still have to live with the mental side of waking up each day and, you know, the flashbacks, the nightmares and, you know, it is. I mean, I'm a survivor myself, so I understand it very clearly. And I also work with survivors of institutional abuse for the Voice of a Survivor. So daily, but I find that it's healing. I find that, like our conversation now, every time I interview somebody, you know, and we talk about certain issues, and there's always something that you relate to, which where you go, fuck, you know what? Yeah, I get it. Or I feel good being able to just put it out there again, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So life's good. Life's good, but mum's good. Kids are well.
Life's great. The kids are great. Life is, and this is, you know what? This is one thing my brother said to me, and I will carry it till the day I die, is he sat on the floor one day when I was so out of it, obviously really clinging onto life. And I remember him saying to me, Nick, life is so much more beautiful on the other side. And I have that as part of my saying in my business, you know.
You jumped the gun on me there, because every guest I have on the clink, just before we say goodbye, I ask them to leave an inspiring quote, verse, word, whatever the fuck it is that is powerful for you. And that right there, say it again. Say it loud and say it proud and get it out.
Life is so much better on the other side. Yeah, so much better.
And that's something that you would definitely pass on to anybody else that is going through what you've gone through.
Yeah, every day. Every person I come into contact with, every time I go out to the Women's Correctional Centre, I run the meetings, the NA, the Narcotics Anonymous meetings out there. Life is so much better on the other side, because I couldn't see that. I was ready to die. I could not see a life on the other side of what I was doing.
Nicole, I just want to say you're a very inspiring woman. I'm honored that you've come on and opened up clearly. You know, it's not easy, one, being a businesswoman, two, a mum, and the fact that, you know, millions of people will end up hearing your story. But I know that you've done it in hope of inspiring somebody else and helping somebody else. And I just want to say thank you. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your openness. And thank you for your story of redemption today on The Clink.
Thank you so much, Brent, for the work that you do.
Absolute pleasure.
Yeah. Thank you. So glad to be here. Please, everyone, just keep tuning into this. Brent, you do some amazing work. And yeah, this is how we get the message across. This is where we give people a glimmer of hope as to go, fuck, if they can do it, maybe it's possible for me. Yeah, so thank you.
Thank you. And thank you to everybody out there listening. We are forever grateful. It doesn't stop. And the more people tune in, the more people we can reach out to you. I hope you've enjoyed episode 3 of season 4. Nicole, thank you again.
For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable. For the record, you ain't trying to grow, then it's done for you. For the record, lab on me going all the way. For the record, ain't trying to link, no time to waste. For the record, 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 for the record.